This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do. Today's guest has certainly traveled many paths before she committed her memoir to ink, Crying Into the Wind by Othello Bach. Othello, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much. I'm so pleased that you're having me as a guest.
Well, Othello, I have looked at your book and certainly read about your history, which honestly was really painful. In fact, you are described as having turned a horrific childhood into a story of courage, and I couldn't agree with that description more. Let's start with the name of your book. I know that the explanation of the title is a little bit further on in the story, but for our guests who are just listening now, why Cry in the Wind? What meaning did that have for you? What memory does that pull up for you?
Well, that's something my mother used to say because we were so extremely poor and there was not anything to eat very often, and it meant we were going to eat whatever grew in the backyard. But if we were crying for something special that she didn't have the money for, which was mainly the case, she would say, you might as well cry into the wind, meaning it's hopeless. I don't have any money. You can't have any crackers. And so that's what I based the title on, because my childhood was such an extended period of hopelessness, and yet I don't feel like, well, I actually feel very, I guess the word is privileged, now that I am an old lady, to have lived that life, because I learned so very much that I've been able to share with people, things about myself, things about other people, and things that we all have in common that can help us succeed.
And certainly you shared things about what homes for children were like as you were growing up. That's an important part of the story as well. I was amused on some levels as I read that when you first wrote about your life, not only did folks tell you that they didn't believe it, that it was just too dreadful to be believable, but they also weren't too thrilled with this name that you anointed yourself with. They didn't believe that was your name.
Yes, they thought I anointed myself, but I was born with the name Othello. That's on my birth certificate. And so, when it was rejected, and with that said, I was most insulted, I think, over them rejecting my name, not believing it. But I would like to share with your guests, listening guests, that my father was an extreme alcoholic. There's seven kids. I was the middle child. We lived in the back of a truck for the first 5 years of my life, literally parking it on any lot that my father could sneak onto without having to pay rent. One summer, we lived in a ditch with a tarp over the top until we almost drowned in a rainstorm. So then we stayed out of the ditch at night. But eventually got a two-room shack, and it burned down, and our mother was killed. Unfortunately, as she ran out the back door, my brother had already pitched out all the little ones, and I was one of those. And we saw her burn, and that was the biggest shock. And then the very night that we buried her, my father took me to his bed so he could get over his grief, which left me with more grief.
Of course.
And then, I'm sorry.
No, I'm agreeing with you that, of course, that would leave you with more grief and a great deal of confusion as to why your father had taken you to his bed. Let me ask you this. I want to back up a little bit, because you've said some things that, and as they've kind of rolled off your tongue, you know, for you, they were your life and that's what you lived, and it just kind of was what it was. But for those who are listening, when you say you lived at the back of a truck, are you saying that you mm-hmm. literally lived at the back of the truck?
It was a big flatbed truck, had sideboards on it, slatted sideboards. Yes, I mean, we literally lived back there. The picture on the front of the book is a picture of that truck.
And that was your home?
That was our home for the first 5 years. Of course, I don't remember those first 5 years. My oldest brother told me. When I asked him, how long did we live in the ditch? And I thought I could only remember one summer. And he said, yeah, and before that, you lived in the back of a truck. He said, we all did. That was, he said, you weren't born in the back of a truck. You were born in a house that was rented, but we soon couldn't pay the rent and got evicted. And that happened a lot, and that's the way my whole story starts, is running from the landlord.
And as you say, as you go through the story, I mean, there are just so many disruptions in your life. And you know, again, the idea that somebody actually lived on the back of a flatbed truck. So let me ask you the obvious. What did you do for a bathroom? What did you do for a shower or a bath? What did you do for food when you and your family were living on a truck?
We fertilized Oklahoma. That's how we went to the bathroom.
Okay.
And so the weeds grew well along the road, and that's what we ate. Collard greens and the greens that Mama knew wouldn't kill us. And I cannot tell you how much I hated them then, and don't go close to them now. Spinach wasn't in that bunch, though, so I ate spinach.
Oh, okay. But you've got some limits set, and I clearly understand why.
Yeah.
Talk
yeah.
about living in a ditch. How did that happen?
Well, we're chugging along in the truck one day, going somewhere, who knows where. My father had just gone into a store. We stopped in a little town. My father went in with my mother and called my brother, two oldest brothers in. They went in too and came out, and my brothers didn't know my father wasn't going to pay for the length of baloney that he had handed my brother. But anyway, so now we're running from the guy that owns the grocery store as well. And so as we're going down the, bumping down the road, and I do remember all of this, was a man coming toward us with some kind of machine. I didn't know what it was. So on the back of his truck, when we sat, my father stopped the truck and stopped the man in the other truck. And as it turns out, the thing on the back of his truck was called a backhoe. And we had one possession at that point, one earthly possession, and that was a headboard and dresser that went into, I think, my parents' bedroom at some point. But anyway, my father traded that headboard and dresser to that man for digging us a ditch. And he took the backhoe, and we're just off. No, my father did not know whose land he's digging on. We're just out in the middle of the country. I asked my brother how long was the ditch. I remember it so clearly, but I, you know, couldn't have told him how. Anyway, he said it was like 8 by 20 feet. And then after he dug the hole, my father, they took the headboard and dresser, and the guy left, and my father said, okay, I'm going into town, get work. And so that's where we were left. And he said, I'll bring back a tarp, put a tarp over the top of it, weighted it down with rocks, and literally lived like a bunch of rabbits. Not for very long, only because, I mean, the rain came. When the rain came, the hole flooded. We barely got out of there. And then from that point on, we lived in that field, though. for a whole summer. And there was a stream that my brothers had found. We washed the clothes in there, that kind of thing. We washed ourselves in that stream. It's just, it's like living, growing up in some jungle.
You know, I'm sure there are people listening who just don't have a concept of what it is like to literally be so poor that you don't have food on the table. I mean, you know, we live in a country where people throw away food all the time, take things for granted all the time, you know, assume that everybody has a place to live. And that was not at all what was going on with you and your family. Do you have a sense that as you were growing up, you were aware that your lives were different from other folks? Or did this just seem to be normal for your family?
No, I did not. We did not know that. Had no awareness until I started school. And when I started school, I had no shoes, and I went barefoot as long as the weather was good. And then when the weather turned cold, and this is after we moved into a two-bedroom shack, okay, and which was following the ditch. We moved into this little two-bedroom shack with a pot-bellied stove in the living room and a wood-burning stove in the kitchen. Anyway, there was no, I had no shoes, and so when it snowed, my mother wrapped my feet in gunny sacks and tied them with bailing wire, and thus I walked to school that way. Now, here's how I know I did not know we were lacking. When I got to school, because she told me, You take the sacks off before you go in the building, and you let them dry in the sun during the day. So I expected to see the bushes covered in gunny sacks, in other words, with everybody's
right.
Shoes. But so I took them off, but I didn't lay them on the top, because all of a sudden I realized, because I saw kids coming in that had rubber boots on. And that's the first time I knew I was different.
Interesting.
And so anyway, I did not lay my gunny sacks on the bushes. I stuffed them under and thought, not wearing those again. Went in with freezing feet, sat on my feet, and my teacher looked aghast. And when I went home then, because we went home to lunch, and it was quite a long walk, but it wasn't so bad as going, because some of the snow had melted. But when I got home, the teacher came to my house with a pair of shoes. And they were boys' brown shoes.
Hmm.
And you would have thought I would have been grateful. I wasn't grateful. My mother was. I was not. I thought those were the ugliest shoes in the world. I'm not going to wear those shoes. But I did wear those shoes because I had no others
to wear. Othello, let me ask you this. What years are we talking about?
We're talking about 1949.
Okay, 1949.
So, yeah.
And was there an average length of time that you and your family stayed in one place?
I have no idea other than these sketchy recollections. So I'm going to say we were probably in the little shack close to a year, but that's what burned down. And so.
And how old were you?
But there's something I need to tell you, though, about that little shack.
Yes.
I want your listeners to know.
Okay.
As I begged my mother for pretty shoes, and there was a Sears Roebuck catalog in the outhouse when we got there. And so when we got into the shack. So I'm begging her for these pretty patent leather shoes. And she was telling me, we don't have the money. We don't have the money. And I kept saying, but I want them shoes. And she would say to me in a very patient voice, as she's got one baby on a hip and another one hanging on her dress, and she's trying to cook something on the stove. And she would say, if you want them bad enough, you can have them. So I thought I had to convince her of how bad I wanted them. But that wasn't it at all. It finally occurred to me after she said that three or four times, and I would beg harder and didn't do any good. The answer was the same. If you want them bad enough, you can have them. It occurred to me, oh, she's saying I'm going to have to get them for myself. Well, how does a seven-year-old kid get money to get shoes?
Right.
I'm just a kid. How am I supposed to do that? Did my big brothers already know this bum situation here? And then I thought, all I can do is cut out paper dolls. But then I thought, yeah, I can cut out paper dolls. I cut out really good paper dolls. I can cut out a big long string of boy dolls and girl dolls. I can sell them on the road where cars are going by. Now, as silly as that sounds as an adult, when I was 7 years old, I never felt a greater sense of pride, confidence, the thrill of thinking I might be self-reliant, that I could make this happen. It so empowered me. I couldn't wait to do it.
That's pretty ingenious.
And what I had to do is wait for paper. We didn't take a newspaper or anything like that. But it was just days later that the house burned down.
Oh, no.
It was shut. So I never got to try that entrepreneurial spirit at that point. But I never forgot it. And many years down the road, when I tried to commit suicide, I remembered it.
And is that what deterred you?
Is that what did what?
Is that what turned you away from committing suicide?
No, I tried.
Okay.
I mean, I took the pills. They didn't do what I thought it was going to do. But there was so much living that went on in between there and when I was 18. And so many horrible situations, they just wouldn't stop. Because after my mother died, after the incest, and my mother died, my father put us in, from me down, and I was seven, and there were three younger than me, in an orphanage. And there, the brutality was, the editor who rejected my book saying things like this haven't happened since Dickens wrote about them. Well, they still go on today, unfortunately, and we have as many kids in orphanages, which are called group homes today.
Right.
And most people think a group home is like eight kids, maybe ten, could be four. There are some huge ones that have as much as 2,500 kids in them. There are others like 1,200. Most of them have 200 to 300. And they're still run by basically the same people, which... they're privately funded, so nobody looks into it.
Othello,
nobody knows.
Othello, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to start with the first group home that you went to and just sort of share with us some of those experiences.
Okay.
That was the Baptist Home for Children. Folks, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will hear more about the Baptist Home for Children. And where was this home located, Othello?
Oklahoma City.
Oklahoma City. Okay. Folks, we'll be right back to hear more from Othello Bach, author of Cry Into the Wind. Don't go away. Stella, before we talk about the home for children, the first one.
Say that again. I was messing with my headset.
Okay. Othello, before we talk about the first group home that you went to with several of your siblings, I'd just like to go back to what I know is a very painful time. Your mother had died, there was a funeral, and then your father took you into his bed. You were a tiny little thing. You had no safety, no protection. Do you remember what you thought? I mean, about what was happening in your world. Your mom was gone, and at that point, the dad you knew was gone.
Well, at that point, I wasn't convinced my mother was dead, which I'll explain. She was burned so badly that they really should not have opened the coffin. But because they were intended to, she had plaster of Paris or something all over her. And I was just big enough to peek over the edge of the coffin. I can see, I'm looking at her from an angle where I see that her nostrils are blocked with something, like a doll. And I didn't want it. She had told me in the hospital that she'd be home by Christmas. But she didn't die that night. She died a few days later. She didn't die the night of the fire. And she told me that, and I believed it with all my heart. She'd never lied to me. And she told me I had to be the example for everybody else because I was the oldest girl, and whatever I did, they would do. I took all that to heart, and then they show me what looks like a mannequin in a coffin. And I thought, she didn't die. She did not die. I do not know why they're hiding her from us. She didn't die. And so I was really probably a really crazy little kid in that I hung on to that belief. I was terrified. I only got to leave the orphanage one time to go buy shoes in town with one of the matrons. And when we went into the first time I was ever in a department store, and at that time I was probably 9 years old or 10, and when I saw the mannequins, I almost passed out because I had never seen a mannequin before. I just thought Mother looked like a doll. And so I had recurring nightmares, horrible nightmares about this doll. And it kept coming to life, but it was mad at me. It wanted to kill me. It wanted to hurt me. And later, much, much later, when I stopped to think about it, then I knew there has to be guilt built into this for me to be terrified of the idea of her waking up and saying, you can't get past me. That's what she would say. You can't get past me. And but I did realize what it was as a little girl, 6 years old, 7 years old, and my sister, just younger than me, 15 months, we would take the little can beside the stove, the kitchen wood-burning stove, that she would use to sprinkle kerosene on the coals of the wood to start it. But she had such a great little spout on this little can, we couldn't resist taking it out and making mud pies because it poured so neatly. And we had no toys, so this was our toy. And the night that she died, it was because she couldn't find that little can. We had taken it out, and in her, it was late at night. Daddy had finally come home with some money, so they went to the store, and we were going to have real food. They came back. It's dark. It's cold. It's miserable. And she thinks the coals are dead in the stove and lifts the 5-gallon can, blew the house apart. And so, anyway, when I realized why I was having the nightmares, and then I was able to do something about it, you know. I mean, I was able to reasonably say, I know I cannot possibly be guilty. I did a childish thing. But at one point, actually, I decided, because I became a hypnotherapist and I used hypnosis on myself a lot, self-hypnosis, so I decided to call that doll up from my mind to talk to it, to see why it was hated me. But anyway, when I did that, and that was a terrifying, terrifying thing to do, because in my head, back in my head, it was still stuck as a menacing thing. Logic wouldn't overrule that. And so I faced it, and because it got closer, it seemed to be coming out of, like, out of a dark black sky, just a tiny speck moving toward me. And as it got really close, I had to turn my head away, literally on the pillow, my eyes shut, and to ask myself, what are you feeling? What are you feeling? For guilt, overwhelming guilt. Okay. So I said to the doll, sit down. Sit down in a chair. And I saw this doll climb into a chair and sit there, look at me. But the look on its face was the most loving, compassionate. It wasn't even forgiving, because there was nothing to forgive. It was just like, oh, I'm so sorry, you're hurting. And what the doll said, because my mother was a writer, and she did have published material, mainly in magazines and newspapers. But anyway, the doll said to me, it's okay, old fellow. You can publish more than I did. I never knew that, as I said, I'm going to be a writer, that I felt guilty for challenging, feeling like I was challenging her memory or something. Now, that's way off the subject of this
it's actually not, because, I mean, so many children, certainly not under circumstances as horrifyingly traumatic as yours, but so many children find themselves feeling guilty about, quote unquote, exceeding their parents in whatever way, that they often find themselves in a self-imposed prison. So it certainly doesn't sound far off the mark at all.
And well, it's in the book. It talks about it. Well, I guess me facing it doesn't, facing the doll and the challenge, because that happened as I was grown. And I decided I want to look into this. Why did I behave that way? So anyway, after that, we went to this first home that you asked about, the Baptist one. And you want me to tell you what it was like. Is that it?
Yes.
Well, it was extremely strict. We were separated and put in different dormitories. And the scariest part of that was the strictness and the way they punished, and that they had a man in the little girl's toilet area. We had two big tubs and sinks and potties, toilets, and that's what I went into. And when I saw that the man was drying off the little girls as they got out of the bathtub, two older girls would wash us, and then we would get out and go to that man to be dried off. When I saw what was happening, very first day I'm there, no way, that's not going to happen, because of what my father had done. I was just suddenly terrified. So I just grabbed my towel away from him and told him I was going to do it myself. But that's also where I found out there are clothes called pajamas. And I had no idea there were clothes for the bed. And the punishment was so dire on one particular incident that stands out. I had never eaten peanut butter. So you got 20 girls at a table, and one, we call them matrons. One matron is watching us.
Was that Miss
Hornaby?
And
so they pass around a big thing of peanut butter, and I don't even know what to do with it, but I'm watching the other girls, and they're smearing it on bread. So I did the same thing, and then when I got through smearing it on the bread, I thought, I licked my knife. Boy, that's really good. So I licked it again. And the matron says, we don't eat with our knives. And I said, wasn't eating, I was licking. And she wasn't happy with my answer. But anyway, Later, I wanted another sandwich of that, later that same meal, because I thought that's about the best stuff I ever put in my mouth. And this time, when I totally forgot. I licked my knife. I did not do it on purpose. It was just like automatic. And boy, she yanked me up, and she put me, locked me up in a basement. And I'd already been told and been down in the basement that there were tarantulas and fire snakes down there. And if the fire snake bit you, you burned up. Well, having seen my mother burn, I could not imagine anything worse. Anyway, I stayed on the top step with my back against the door, my eyes shut, terrified. And what really got me was I thought I heard the kids all still in the next room, because the doorway to the basement was right off the dining area. So I thought they were all still there eating and having a good time. But when finally the door opened and I fell out, because I was pushed against it so hard, the dining room was clean, the kitchen was dark, then I became even more scared to think a fire snake could have eaten me up and nobody would have known.
Othello,
just that kind of thing.
Othello, was this Mrs. Hornaby who was treating you this way?
Yeah.
Okay, so she was really a piece of work on a lot of levels.
Yeah, she was.
Now, and I noticed as I was going through your memoir that you and your siblings were separated. You were in the same home, but you weren't allowed to be in the same area. You were even in separate buildings, as I recall.
That's right. That's right. And that was truly the next hardest thing to watching my mother burn, was even in the second orphanage. And let me explain why we're in two. After a year and a half, my father had a common law wife he was living with, and apparently she made him feel guilty enough that he should get us out. And he did. But he put us in like a fourth-rate motel that he was renting. It was like two rooms. All us little kids there. I was to watch him. My older brother was to come by, and he was like 15, I think. He was to come by and watch us at night, stay there at night. Well, anyway, there was nobody watching us during the day, and we were a pain in the butt for everybody around, including
how many,
the guy who...
How many of there were you?
Yeah, there were four.
Okay, and you were the one charged with watching the others?
Yeah.
And you were how old?
I was 10 at this point. Hmm. 9 or 10. No, it was 9, because we were only there for 5.5 months before the city ordered my father to do something with us or stay with us. And so the next best thing in his mind was another orphanage. So we could not go back to where we were, because we were living in Texas, and the other orphanage only took children from Oklahoma. So we were taken to the second one. Now, this time, because we'd already been abandoned once by him, we were morbid. We knew what to expect. We knew how lonely and horrible it's going to be. And so we begged him and begged him, "Daddy, don't leave us, please." I mean, even after we're there in the lobby, and he finally said, "Get away. Don't you understand? I don't want you." And at the time, I tried to tell myself, well, he's crying, so he doesn't mean that. And I'm sure he did feel horrible, but I'm also sure he meant that, because he walked out while we're just begging him not to go. And two ladies come in, and we know we're going to be separated. We know what happened last time. So my little sisters and I had two little sisters, and we all grabbed each other in this group hug. We were not going to let them take us away, split us up. And we clung to each other so hard, crying, "Don't do this, don't do this." And they did. They separated. We never, ever got to be together again. We're there, I was there for another 9 years. And so that was as bad as watching Mother die, because the loneliness was just incredible. And the monotony and the routine of the orphanage, plus the violence. And the violence was a daily thing.
What was the violence of the orphanage?
What was the violence?
Yes.
Oh, well, a lot of beatings for small infractions, sewing a spit wad, that kind of thing. One of the Bible classes, and this was when I was about 12 or 13, one of the Bible classes is being taught by a gym teacher, a guy who taught the boys' gym, not us, but he's teaching the Bible class, and he has young teenage girls to teach, and he told us not to talk. And one of the girls talked, and he told her, okay, for that, she was going to have to come up with so many times that the devil's called Lucifer in the Bible, like 25 times or something. And she said, okay, and that was for the next class, or she was going to be punished. And she came back the next class, and she told him, well, Joe, I can't, there aren't, it doesn't do that. There aren't 25 times that the devil's called Lucifer. And he said, I know. Now come here and I'll show you what I really do when girls talk in my class. And he had a huge board. I mean, I'm not lying. 18 inches at least, half inch thick, with holes drilled in it, which is the way the boards they use. So when they hit you hard enough, the skin popped beneath those holes. And he beat her so badly. And we were just horrified as he just beat her and beat her. And a couple of boys, because girls and boys did not mingle at all, but they were walking past the gym where this class was being held. Teenage boys, they stepped in. They saw what was happening. Juanita, who was being beaten, was totally unconscious on the floor, and he just kept going, beating her in the air and anything. And they came running in, and they took the paddle away from him, grabbed her, dragged her out, and we all left too, because Joe, the coach, who was probably 35 years old, strong, really handsome man, I remember that, like a football player build, and he's still flailing around like he's hitting somebody, yelling, this is what I do, this is what you don't talk in my class. So we all ran out too, because the boys could only take this bleeding limp body halfway across the campus without them getting in trouble. So we stepped in, of course, and dragged her on to the dormitory that she lived in, which was most of us lived in at that time. And she didn't walk for weeks, and they did not take her to the doctor. We had a new matron at that point, I remember, and when the new matron saw what happened, how badly she was beaten, she fell apart. She just totally fell apart. And the next day when we came home from school, she was gone. And we had somebody who knew how to handle the situation the way they wanted it.
Interesting.
In charge again. So that's the kind of violence I'm talking about.
It is the kind of violence, again, that people don't even imagine. I mean, it just seems unreal. And yet for you, it was a regular part of your life for much of your life. Othello, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue. And I'd like to hear about what your life is like today.
Okay.
We'll be right back. Othello, for, as I said before the break, for so much of your life, you endured extraordinary and persistent painful experiences, emotionally, socially, physically, psychologically, any pain that one could even begin to imagine were things that you experienced. You didn't even learn how to read until you were in the eighth grade. And yet today, as you and I talk, you have written 16 adult and children's books. You've written stories. You've written music and lyrics that have been recorded by well-known individuals. How did you get to be the person you are today? What happened? How did you survive?
Well, I'll tell you, it was learning to read. The pivotal point in my life was learning to read, which I taught myself under the covers when I finally discovered that letters had sound assignments. And I knew my name and how to spell it, and I had just figured out that CH had a particular sound. And because of that, I thought, well, I've got half the alphabet. I'm going to teach myself. And so up to that point, I lied and cheated. I was a very creative cheater. My teachers, anybody who might have noticed, either didn't or didn't care. So anyway, but as I'm
Othello, let me just interrupt you for a moment. The notion that a child could get to the eighth grade, which means that she's in school, and she's been around other adults, and she's unable to read, and no one has bothered to take the time to teach her to address that issue, you know, I want to say it's astounding, but as you said earlier, these things continue to happen.
Well, like I said, I was very creative, a liar, a very creative cheater, because I didn't even tell the other kids I couldn't read. What I did do was say, I'll wash your clothes, I'll clean your floor, I'll do whatever I need to, if you'll read this to me, because I hate to read. They would read me the assignments. I've always been very verbal, able to express myself, so I could hold up my hand and I could answer questions and that sort of thing. And when it came to spelling tests and written tests, I cheated. So I would swap work for, let me copy your assignment. And so if that's how I skated, that's how I skated. But when I learned to read, here's the huge thing that I want your listeners to hear. As I was sounding out the words in a scary story, I suddenly felt very afraid. And I thought that was so incredible that I should feel afraid. And all I'm doing is reading a book. But I was so afraid, I was breathing hard. I can remember my heart just pounding. So I stopped reading and said, what's happening? What's happening? What's happening? And I realized it was the words going through my mind that were creating this fear. And I thought, wow, that's huge. If words create the way I feel, I can control it from this point on. I can make my life something different. I don't have to be angry. I don't have to be sad. I can tell myself words that make me feel better. Now, I'm not saying I remember to use it every time I should, especially throughout my teen years. But when I was 18 and left there, there was one, because I went to live with my father, there was no one else to go live with, to finish the last 3 months of high school, because I had enough for the orphanage. I wasn't going to take, I was about to take one of those meetings, and I just wasn't going to do it. So when I went to live with my father, he said, get out. As soon as you graduate, I don't want you. And so I go for a job interview, and I'm so dumb. I'm so naive. I can't, I've never held money in my hands or anything like this. And the guy says to me, he needed some help taking some boxes into a storage room, blah, blah, blah. And would I help him? And I said yes. And in this, it was a warehouse place. All of a sudden, he's behind me, and it became a rape situation. And that's when I decided I'm going to end it. Man, if you can't even trust a person running a job interview to have a job, because I asked him when the whole thing was done, and I was just stunned. And I said, did you even have a job to offer? He said, no, just very casually, no. And I was, at that point, that's when I went totally crazy and thought, you can't trust a job interview. Why do you want to stay alive? You can starve to death if you can't get a job. And so I took a bottle of pills that I knew someone had, and I just swiped them and took them. And it's a brand new prescription of Dexedrine and 30 pills, and I thought that would do it. It did not do it. I was in a coma for 2 days. It was when I got out of the coma that I remembered my mother saying, if you want it bad enough, you can have it. And I suddenly knew I had to control my thoughts. I had to control every thought. And that's what saved me.
That is a simply extraordinary. The books that you have written, 16.
Oh, by the way, the number of books at this point is 30.
30.
30 books on Amazon.
I got
30 books on Amazon right now. Yeah.
I stand in.
And a bunch more that are written, but I got to get them where they need to go.
I stand entirely corrected. 30 books is an extraordinary number, and they are for children as well as adults.
Children and adults. I write how-to books. I write thrillers. I write children's. I write spiritual books. I was a minister for 10 years. So how am I today? You wanted to talk about that?
Yes.
I'm wonderful. I love it. I love my life. I love everything about it. I've had a wonderful adulthood. I do watch my thoughts. Actually, it becomes a habit eventually, so that you don't get into the dark places. And so I've been at that for many years. So I have wonderful life, a totally blessed life.
What's an average day like for you today? Or is there an average day?
Oh, there's pretty much average. It's a little different with this campaign of promotion going on. But an average day is writing, mostly. And other days, it's all music, new compositions. And then recently, I've illustrated about 3 of my children's books. That's mainly because I can't find an artist that I can here in this little town that has the time and whatnot to work with me. But so I've always liked to draw and paint and compose music and write stories. So my life's wonderful. That's what I do.
It sounds like your mother's spirit continues to be very much a part of you.
A wonderful thing happened a year ago. I got a note from a lady who said, oh, fellow, I am your mother's youngest sister. Well, youngest sister. My mother was 10 years older than her. She saw me when I was 3 months old and then moved to California. We were in Oklahoma. She never saw me again. For 40 years, I lived in California and didn't know she was there. And in 2000, moved to Indiana. But we connected about a year ago. And that has been such a great joy.
That's wonderful.
Having her in my life.
Othello, for those listening who have been through traumatic experiences, is there anything in particular you would like to say to them? There's a program that you created. I don't know if you want to talk about that or if there's just anything, any words that you can offer.
Oh, yes. I'd love to. It's a 30-day step-by-step program of a happiness program. It's also soul separate. It's in my book, Crying to the Wind. It's the last chapter. But it's also sold independently. You can look at my website and find all of my books. And my website is othellobach.com, and that's B-A-C-H. Anyway, it's called The Happiness Option. and when it's sold individually. Yes, I used it first on after I developed it. I started using it with Vietnam vets in Anaheim, California. They were so thrilled at the difference they felt after 30 days of working this program that they actually surrounded me at the end of that last meeting. We met once a week. And they said, we've got to get this out to the general public. And they set up 6 seminars in Los Angeles and Southern California for me. And I didn't have to do a thing except go there and talk about the program. So I would say to anybody who is having trouble with experiences from the past, worrying about the future, that kind of thing, to look at the happiness option or buy my book and get the whole story plus the happiness option and try it. It's a remarkable program. Once in a while, I wake up with things being told to me by my voice in my head, like a story. And those things I know get up and write. Well, the happiness option is one of those things. Mm. And that it was just my mind was telling it to me, and I didn't have to think about it. I just had to get up and type it out.
And that's what you did. Othello, for those listening who are working in group home facilities, any words of wisdom or caution?
I'm not sure. It's such a futile situation. The only requirement to work in a group home is to watch over children is a GED and a driver's license. And how do I know it? I take the newsletter that advertises for the jobs, okay? It's rare. It's rare that they even have a counselor like you or a doctor associated with the facility. So they're run primarily, they're paid for by churches. And the churches believe they're doing a good thing. But nobody ever stops. And when I call the health department, federal Department of Health, to find out how many kids are in them, they don't keep records of group homes. Mm. I said, that can't be true. I called back 3 times thinking I would get different people, somebody with better information. Group homes, they don't know how many kids are there. But what I counted up, because I contacted every one of them and asked them how many kids have you got under your care. And every state has them. And 600,000 was about what it came out to, which is the same as in foster care. And I do speak to foster parents, and I love being able to do that.
600,000 people in group homes, there's no particular accounting for them. And
that's right.
What you're saying is that there are some group homes that have some pretty archaic
pretty
ways
nasty.
Of treating people.
Pretty nasty problems because they just hire the cheapest people they can, you know, and yet they're making really good money doing that. And I hate to say that in case there are people looking for a job that are listening to your program and they have no idea how to do it, but they want the money. And that's generally what happens. So it's discouraging, and I do hope I'm wanting to go to Congress and do something about it. Go before them and say something. Right now, everything's so up in the air with a new president. It'll be months before anything settles down to do anything.
The energy and the wisdom that you are able to share, and the extraordinary, as I said earlier, the consistency of the extraordinary traumas that you experienced, and yet you are living proof that your present does not have to be defined by your past, that you can make a choice, you can make a difference in your own
right.
life.
That's right. In other words, the past is literally gone. It cannot hurt us. In fact, any pain we have, whether physical or emotional, the thing that hurt is already gone. If you drop a rock on your toe, by the time you feel the pain, the rock has already bounced off. Same thing is true if somebody says something that hurts your feelings. By the time the words pass through your mind, it's gone. So it literally is stay in the present, because if you look in the future and start worrying, you get yourself in the same mess. So I just don't do those things.
So let the past stay where it is, let the future stay where it is, and be present where you are right now.
Well, the truth is you can only be present anyway.
Well, that's
true. You can't
be
in the future, and you can't be in the past.
That's true.
So it's like, that's trying to defy reality, right? Stay where your nose is, okay?
Okay, fair enough. Othello Bach, thank you for the book. Thank you for you, Cry in the Wind by Othello Bach, and that is O-T-H-E-L-L-O. The last name is B-A-C-H. Thank you again for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk.
And let me tell them that they can go to my website.
Yes.
And if they have a question about any of this, my email address is there, okay?
Terrific. It's at the website, and the website is othellobach.com.
That's right.
Okay. Terrific. Thank you again so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Well, thank you, Dr. Burr. It's been delightful.
I am happy, and I know that your energy and that your survival skills have certainly made a difference in the lives of everyone who has heard your story today. So thank you.
Well, thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications and is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes store and have it available to you that way all the time. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, that email address is pamela@mindtalk.org. That's pamela@myndtalk.org. And folks, I want you to always, always remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.